the monologue.
Even though we have just basically got the election results in the city of Seattle, understandably so, a lot of residents, myself included, are ready for a change in direction, not just a change in leadership, but what will come of that leadership on the topic of homelessness. Homelessness has completely overtaken the city of Seattle. It is sad. There are a lot of you who have mentioned to me via text that you will not visit Seattle. You won't even come for a game that you otherwise would check out, or a concert, or for a restaurant, because of how much the city has degraded, how wherever it is you look, you end up seeing tents. And those tents, unfortunately, usually are occupied by folks who can be a danger to you. And it's not just impacting the quality of life, it's obviously impacting businesses. Christina DeGuarde is a business owner, Beyond Threads. And right outside of her front door in the Pioneer Square District, she's got homeless tents.
This tent right here that went on Friday, and he's literally not even 20 feet from our doorway.
And what do you think that does to a potential customer? They're not doing any window shopping. They're not jumping inside unless they're trying to run away from someone who's homeless who might be antagonizing them. And it seems like the city right now, instead of doing any sort of enforcement, they'll sweep from time to time, but very, very rarely. And they're not really getting serious about getting people into homes or really forcing them to either take the resources or get out of town. Ultimately, sometimes that's what you have to do with folks. I was at the Fox studio yesterday, and I'll be there again today. And I noticed that that giant homeless encampment that is across the street from the studio was starting to get cleared. But I guarantee you that the folks who have been cleared didn't go into hotel rooms that are open or tiny home villages. They're just moving somewhere else, and they'll likely be back. Once it's fully cleared, I'll take the photo, and then we can do a countdown on when it's going to be reoccupied by various tents. These people aren't just sitting there minding their own business.
Yesterday, he was smoking drugs right in front of us.
People don't want to have to deal with that. People aren't going to go into a business when you're dealing with that. And so folks right now are wondering how soon before they see some change. Now, the truth of the matter is, it's going to take a while. We talked about that. But there are some things that can be done right now by this mayor, now that she knows, as she's on her way out, she doesn't have to be completely a lame duck mayor. She can start to make some of these moves and just order these sweeps. Tell the cops that, yes, you can now do your jobs again. The council can get involved. Sure, it's going to take some time. But you know what? The people of Seattle have spoken. And if you believe that Mayor Bruce Harrell, mayor-elect, is going to get into office and actually do what he said, which is get more aggressive in cleaning up our parks and our streets, our sidewalks, our alleyways, why not just pick up right now and get the ball rolling so that when Bruce Harrell gets into office and his administration is in place, all of a sudden, he won't have to start from scratch. He'll be able to start from first base or second base. Why not just get that ball rolling now? Of course, this is a mayor who politically has not been very strong. She doesn't know how to deal with the politics of the city. She's not an administrator, and you don't always need to be an administrator, but you're either a good administrator or a good politician or both. And if you're neither, then you get Mayor Jenny Durkan, who's allowed this council to run roughshod over her. It doesn't have to be this way, but she's choosing it to. She's just got weeks left in office. And right now, in a memo, she can order sweeps and she can order cops to start arresting people who are breaking the law, who have shown no interest in getting help. That would put Bruce Harrell in a better position. Will she ultimately do that? Probably not. You need to have a good leader in power to do something like that. And even though the people of Seattle have spoken, have said, we want course correction, she's not going to take that risk.
The interview.
An interesting development out of a city council race in Lynnwood, where the 21-year-old who currently is the front runner, he's currently in the lead. It turns out he's got some potential issues with his financing. Joining me on the line to discuss is that guy who tracks down all the shady stuff that might be going on in campaigns, Glenn Morgan from We the Govern. Glenn, welcome back to the show.
Jason, thank you so much for having me on the air.
So in this case, we're talking about a local activist out of Linwood. He's actually only 21 years old. His name is Joshua Binda. He's currently in the lead, but you're saying there's some red flags with some of his financing.
Yeah, and I mean, I know the Everett Herald recently wrote an article about it, and the Luma Times covered it earlier more thoroughly. But there was a substantial amount of problems with this campaign where he was caught admitted spending, thousands and thousands of dollars on what is clearly personal expenses, like jewelry, $165 haircuts, groceries, rent to somebody, a laptop that he paid for twice, kickbacks to his friends, towing charges, all kinds of expenses. And in fact, it was the majority of the money that he raised. And I'm going to point out, he raised more money than anybody else running for that city council seat or for any city council seat in Linwood this year. And it raised a lot of red flags, particularly since his professional treasurer, Andy Lowe, who's well-known, had quit the campaign for no clear reason back in August. And it looked like a good percentage of the odd and strange expenditures were all happening after Andy had quit the campaign.
So all in, we're talking about his campaign raising about $27,000 or so, and apparently he spent about $18,000 or so. Are you suggesting that the problems are illegal, or are you suggesting that it's just some funky stuff going on behind the scenes that maybe he's not doing intentionally? Like, where are you? What does your investigation find?
Well, they're unambiguously illegal under Washington State's campaign finance laws. So they're clearly, it's RCW 42-17A-445. I'm sorry, I practically memorized that statute with all these complaints, but essentially it's just, these are all personal, clearly defined, non-campaign related expenditures, at least as they reported them. Now, his story right now, and it's evolved over the last few days, is that, this was just an accident, didn't mean to, but it was the majority of the expenditures for his campaign that were spent that way. And it is a red flag if both your campaign manager and your treasurer quit after the and for no clear reason after the primary, and then suddenly all these expenditures occur. The other thing I'm going to point out is that, and I don't know if this complaint's public yet, but the guy who wrote the article, the Linwood Times, actually went out there and looked at the books, attempted to, the day before the campaign, and the campaign was unable to produce any receipts, according to him, and unable to produce bank statements. And unable to do anything else. So my sense is it's probably a big rat's nest, and who the heck knows what's really going on here. So it's going to be an investigation of some kind.
Well, there should be an investigation if there's even the appearance of wrongdoing. I imagine, him being 21 years old and kind of feels like he's already throwing this out there, or at least that's the excuse that's being thrown out there, is, I'm new to this. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just 21 years old. Should that matter? Does that matter?
Right. Oh, I think it does. I mean, it does matter a bit. Yeah, at the same time, when you have professionals around you, and he did, that's less of an excuse than he might want to put on, and the fact that those professionals quit, and for probably a good reason, even if they, the PDC eventually, of course, is going to have to subpoena, and it's going to be quite a bit of a process now as they go to dig into this, provided they're actually willing to look at it. But, it's a serious violation. I've actually not found anybody go this far into a Christmas shopping program or a shopping spree for himself for any campaign in the past.
So what are the next steps and what are the possible punishments?
The PDC is going to spend the next probably 2 to 6, maybe 8 weeks digging into it, depending on the lacking documents they have there. And they will either, I would say this one's probably most likely to result in a fine of some kind. It probably will not be huge since he is a first-time candidate, but it probably will be some kind of a fine. I mean, at some point in time, they'll have to apply this law to Democrats like they do to Republicans. So, I would guesstimate that they probably do something like that. I don't think he can talk himself out of that, and so the only question is how big it'll be. It probably won't be a huge one, but it'll probably be a fine and a good little notice that maybe next time, I'm certainly hopeful that when he gets into office, he doesn't treat the city's finances the same way he treated his personal campaign finances.
Well, this one I will definitely 100% lean on the 21-year-old thing. He will 100% not be a good steward of finances like most 21-year-olds. The question then becomes, will it be done with nefarious intent or just because he's 21 years old? But we'll figure that out once he actually starts spending the money. And this is assuming he is declared the winner. I know it's a little tight still. It seems likely he's going to win, but we'll end up finding out in the coming day. In fact, we might find out later tonight. WeTheGovern.com, that's the website you should go to right now to learn more about the work that Glenn Morgan is doing. Thank you so much for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Jason, thank you for having me on.
Of course. Now this.
The monologue.
Undoubtedly, today saw some really good job numbers. Really good job numbers. For the first time in a very long time. And even though it's happening under the Biden administration, we should acknowledge that the 530,000 plus new jobs is a good thing, mostly being propped up by the hospitality industry. But at the same time, it's also true that you have a lot of people who are not working. More than 100 million people aren't in the labor force for the 14th straight month. And it's not that there aren't jobs available. We know that there are jobs available. They are choosing not to look. They're choosing not to look. Now, depending on your position on this, your political position, you either think this is a result of a whole bunch of handouts that have been given to people to stay unemployed, or you think it's because of COVID, that they're too scared. I'm someone who thinks a little bit of both. Not that they're too scared of COVID, but that you have vaccine mandates in place and that's going to keep people home, while at the same time you've made it easier for people to stay at home. Now, for some reason, this administration believes that a vaccine mandate is actually going to get people back into the job market. They are taking a calculation. They believe that people are still too scared to even leave their house and go to a job as a result of COVID, despite the fact that they are most likely already vaccinated. I mean, are they telling us that the people who aren't working are unvaccinated? Why are they unvaccinated? They're either unvaccinated by choice or they're unvaccinated by a small medical chance of a medical condition that they know would hurt them, but they want the vaccine. It's not people who are vaccinated or staying home because it's too dangerous. Why would it be dangerous to them if they're already vaccinated? Here is the labor secretary. He was on with Stuart Varney on Fox Business today. Marty Walsh.
I think part of it is fear of the pandemic, fear of the virus. And what we did, the action we took yesterday with the emergency temporary standard for companies over 100 or more employees, either testing or either vaccination or testing. I think that's one area that'll help us with it. Number one. I think secondly, in some cases, it's childcare and strengthening childcare as well, and getting more women and families back into the market. I think that's another area. And I think building confidence in people's ability to feel that we're moving forward. If you look at the report, and I've been on here now for the last 7 months. When we saw the spike in the Delta variant, we saw more people getting out of the workforce. As we see these numbers go down, and hopefully they continue to trend down, we're seeing more people go into the job force.
So there is a lot wrong with his analysis, to be clear. There's a lot wrong. Why are people scared to go back into the workforce? What would change? You're telling me that as a vaccinated person, they are scared to go back in with the potential of seeing someone who's unvaccinated, yet at the same time, this is the same administration that tells us people are going to businesses in record numbers and creating the supply chain problem because of their demand. So they're comfortable going out. They're comfortable going to a grocery store in larger numbers than they have before. They're comfortable going into retail in general than they were before, restaurants in particular. And yet they're too scared to go to work? No, of course not. Now, I also think there are people who have permanently decided that they're not going to go to work in the traditional sense. They don't want to go back into an office. And maybe they're taking more time to look for a job that allows for them to have a quote-unquote work-life balance. And by balance, I mean they spend all of their time at home instead of going back into the office, which is something that we need to start pushing back against. That's not good for the workforce. That cannot be true, what they're saying on the vaccine, though, or on COVID fears. Very clearly, people have left the workforce because of the COVID vaccine mandate. Some of them done it intentionally. They decided to just quit. Others were let go. Now, there's a report that says 37% are leaving the workforce because of the mandate, something that Secretary Walsh says is not true.
Where mandates have actually gone into play in companies, a lot of people eventually get the vaccine. They're not leaving the job market. I don't think 37% of the populace that's saying that they're not going to get vaccinated or tested, they're going to leave the job market. I think what we have to do is just continue to explain what it is that we're doing here with this emergency temporary standard.
Yeah, you're forcing people into a vaccine they might not want. That's what you're doing. And to pretend that to downplay the number of people who are leaving the workforce as a result of this is silly. And it's not based in the data. Is it as high as 37%? I have no idea. Does that number seem a little high? Yeah. what would seem a little bit more realistic, about 10 to 20% probably. To my eye, that would make a little bit more sense given the number of people who are choosing to be unvaccinated. But this whole idea that none of this is playing a role is just so silly, and they keep denying reality, which is why I say this is the gaslighting presidency. We are right now in a world of gaslighting, and there doesn't seem to be any attempt to let up.
The interview.
My next guest alleges that Pat Chun, the athletic director over at Wazoo, threatened him verbally in a profane confrontation, all because of a video that was posted. Joining me on the line to discuss is Pullman City Councilmember Al Sorensen. Councilmember, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Hi, Jason.
Apparently, your daughter had taken a video, short video, of Pat as he was having a party of some kind at his home. Pat Chun is the athletic director over at Wazoo. She made a note in the video to point out that no one seems to be wearing a mask. And as a result, somehow you got confronted. What happened?
Yeah. So just a quick timeline on things here, and just to let you know. There was a party going on, and my daughter happened to drive by on a public street and took a short video just showing the party going on with no masks and that kind of thing, and just posted it online just saying, hey, no masks, you know?
Yeah.
The next thing we know is that on September 29th, the Chuns entered my place of business here, kind of figured that they would say or do something. We had some business with them at the time, and I figured they'd probably want to move that or something. So I actually had gotten a phone call from a local insurance agency saying that they were moving it. And while I was working on the paperwork, they walked in the door. At that point, they... First off, just asked if there was anything else that needed to be done with that. And when that little bit of transaction was done, Mr. Chun changed his tune quite heavily and started attacking me and my daughter, mostly me at the time, verbally, very aggressively, and extremely threatening with massive profanity. In just a massive tirade, I don't want to say the F word.
Yeah, please don't. But what was the message that he was sending?
He was, I believe, upset about the video that had been posted, and he was accusing me of posting the video. Said I didn't post the video, and at a point in this conversation, my daughter said I posted the video. He looked at her and then just basically looked back at me and continued on with a tirade about how he was going to destroy my business. Destroy my wife's business. He was going to make people aware of all kinds of things about me. It's all in the police report mm-hmm. and everything there of what he said. And it was very threatening. And he kept getting aggressive. He kept moving closer to my desk. I was sitting at my desk, never stood up. And I'll tell you this, and I said this in the police report, it felt like if I stood up, it probably would have got physical, so I just stayed where I was at, very calm and cool, no profanity from me or anything. Finally got him to leave the office, and I immediately called a police officer to come by because I wanted to tell him what happened. It was decided by me that I didn't need to file anything at that point, and what I told the officer was, well, okay, that's fine, I can do it later, but I'm not going to file anything unless Mr. Chun follows through with the threats that he had made in here.
Did he follow through with the threat? We only have about a minute left.
Yeah, we go 2 weeks later on October 18th. I find out from another person in the industry that's in Spokane that he's bad-mouthing me. So his threats now became actions, and they were no longer threats. So I called the police officer that I talked to at first, gave him the full report, and there we go. So that's what happened. You know, the things that he's saying about me out there right now, he says... all kinds of things. I'm the victim. I'm the one that he went into the person's place of business, and I was the one that was assaulted. I'm the one he yelled and screamed at. I didn't go into his office and do that. I just think at this time he's being extremely very vindictive.
Mm-hmm.
He is He was the one out of line, not me. He's being a bully and all kinds of things. I think people can see for themselves what the truth is out there. I did not go to his office, okay? You'll notice that he hasn't explained really what he said in my office. That's because he can't. He knows what he said in my office.
And just to clarify, because you used the term assault, you're saying verbally assaulted.
Verbally, not physically.
Just wanted to clarify that. And, you know, exactly. I'll say this, because the more I look into this, I don't cover this beat all that often, but I did break a story a couple weeks ago of just a few days after letting the now former head coach Nick Rolovich go over the vaccine mandate. Pat Chun was in a small room indoors without a mask, along with a whole bunch of other people without masks on. So this is clearly someone who doesn't think the rules apply to him, but would happily apply the rule to Nick Rolovich. Now, in fairness, the party was not actually in violation of anything. I get your bigger picture point, but his party was outdoors, so he wasn't actually violating any rule in that case. But I do have a tendency to push back against the people who are, you know, such sticklers to not accommodating others. But, you know, he wants to be accommodated with an outdoor gathering versus Nick Rolovich, who apparently can't be accommodated playing outdoors. We've been talking.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd. We've been talking with Pullman City Council Member Al Sorensen. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us your story. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Jason, real quick, I want to make one thing clear.
This 10 seconds.
Has nothing to do with WSU or athletics or Nick Rolovich. This is an entirely separate incident.
Absolutely, and I think that's what it sounds like to me. Thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Now this.
The Jason Rance Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rance.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rance, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Well, voters in Seattle decided finally to course correct. How long it lasts, how soon before we see results, we don't know. But obviously, three out of the four Seattle races for mayor, for city attorney, and one of the two council races went to the way of the more moderate, or in one case, an actual Republican. And they didn't just win by a squeaker. They actually dominated these races. So what does this all mean? Joining me on the line is Saul Spady, former host of the Saul Spady Show right here on KTTH, formerly of the Ken Wilson campaign. Welcome to the show.
Oh, Jason, thanks so much for having me and letting me talk about such an exciting night for Seattle city politics. I do want to say one quick aside. It's a poor couple of days for King County elections.
Yep.
Are we the slowest in the country, or are we just trying to be the slowest in the country counting ballots?
I think it's because they know that the media can make more stories when they go slow out of the results. So in a way, I kind of appreciate it. But the good news is, obviously, as all the votes get tallied, things tighten slightly, but the results are what they are. What was the biggest takeaway first, your sort of top line takeaway?
Far left extremist candidates can't win in Seattle, or at least will have a very hard time winning in Seattle, which is it's a blessing, right? We've been watching kind of Seattle city council candidates, Seattle mayoral candidates, you know, get closer and closer to the left. Nikita Oliver was almost the candidate against Jenny Durkin 4 years ago. And finally, the far left and the stranger got their way, and they got, you know, a police abolitionist through Nikita Oliver, who you can't really find a plan to fix our bridges, which is a huge issue in Seattle, like all of these extreme candidates. And those candidates just didn't succeed. The message is there is a limit to what the Seattle city voter can tolerate. Now, will that limit be met again and again to keep allowing people like Ann Davidson through as a Republican? That's hard for me to see, right? I mean, I would almost ask you, Jason, do you think Ann Davidson would have beaten Pete Holmes? After watching this election, I don't think she would have.
No, Pete Holmes would have won. I think your point is right. I think my caveat, and I think this is what you mean, is citywide, these kinds of politicians can't win. You'll still get very far to the left folks in certain areas, right? Shama Sawan is very, very far to the left, as is Tammy Morales. And even though I believe Dan Strauss and Lisa Herbold and the others tend to be very, very far to the left, they are not covered in that way. They don't talk about themselves in that way. And Nicole Thomas Kennedy, this abolitionist, or Nikita Oliver, another abolitionist, that was their brand. And citywide, at least right now, folks realize they have already gone pretty far to the left and haven't seen the results that maybe they thought they would have? Does the fact that this was a low turnout election play a role? Yeah, probably does. Usually, though, in the past, that's actually favored some of the extremists.
Well, and let's be honest, all Seattle City elections are low turnout elections. It's kind of one of the mistakes, I think, because they're all off years, right? 2021, 2019, 2023, right? You're never on the ballot with, you know, even though it pains me to say it, a more rational person like Jay Inslee compared to Ashama Sawant, right? I think an Egan Orion wins when Jay Inslee's on the ballot. With all that being said, I think the other message is when there's a slate of strong moderate candidates, we do really well. Ken Wilson could have won, and I put some work into helping Ken's campaign, and he was running on a very simple message of we can do better on our infrastructure and our bridges. Mosqueda was running on a pretty simple message of I'm just going to keep being the exact same person I've been on the council for the last 4 years. And for some reason, the moderate group didn't include Ken in their kind of slate of Harrell, Nelson, Davison, and that's why they lost. But when you trumpet people's the good things about them and you talk about, you know, the negatives of the incumbent or the candidate you don't like, you can really create a sweeping movement. So I guess my biggest disappointment is what was left out there, because this council could have really used somebody who focused on infrastructure, right? Our infrastructure is so good in Seattle.
Yeah, no kidding. We definitely have no potholes and no bridges that are broken. Joining me on the line is Saul Spady. We're talking about Seattle in the aftermath of this pretty significant election. You know, you and I both hold the general view is of we don't know how long this lasts. We don't know if we go into the midterms next year, we see another significant sweep. We don't know if all of a sudden Seattle voters are starting to moderate themselves in the truest sense of the word. Do you think, though, if it was a moderate Republican against a left liberal, do you think that moderate Republican could ever win?
Statewide or at a mayoral level?
Citywide.
No, I think you still need that really big decision, right? Like, if I vote for NTK and I get assaulted by a homeless person, will that be a misdemeanor crime? And like, no, it wouldn't. And underneath Ann Davison, like, yes, it would. That makes it much easier to vote for Ann Davison. I will point to Virginia as like a really interesting corollary. And one of my favorite quotes out of this election, kind of from a pundit, is this idea that, you know, voters, political parties always want you to think about the past, like be afraid of former President Trump, or, you know, if it comes to that, be afraid of former President Biden. But voters, they live in the present and they vote to the future. And so if you have candidates talking about the issues that matter, i.e. Yes. homelessness, i.e. safety, i.e., you know, lowering the cost of living, you're going to win. And that's what we saw in Virginia, and that's what I hope we'll continue to see in Seattle. The only misnomer to that is the Wilson campaign, right? Because he really did stick to what I think is one of the top issues, which is infrastructure. But his campaign just didn't catch fire because, I don't know, people held their nose and voted for a Republican, and so then they had to vote for Teresa Mosqueda to not fix the bridges.
Maybe, but I think your big picture point is 100% true, that when you focus on actual issues, you win. Now, there are anomalies. Biden versus Trump was an anomaly because everyone made that about the two personalities, and you can do that a little bit easier in a national election, but when we're talking about local elections, when you actually focus on the issues that matter and making sure that you're actually picking the issues that matter, and you end up seeing the results that you might want to see. And so I'll let you wrap this up. What do you think will happen statewide as a result of the shift in Seattle? Because when you look so far at this election statewide, kind of a mixed bag. I think there's more plus for the Republican side than for the liberal side. Where do you think things go?
You know, it's going to be dark first. My line has been, will the last statewide Republican please turn out the lights? On the West Coast, and that's Kim Wyman, right? She's joining the Biden administration as Secretary of State. I do think we really need to look to Virginia and kind of your words, Jason. If we focus on the issues that matter to regular voters here, high cost of living, homelessness, safety, the addiction problem that we see outside of our windows every time we drive through Seattle and King County, we've got a great chance. I mean, there's a lot of candidates that have some marks against them. I mean, even Adam Smith, who's a very moderate congressman, you know, over 20 years in Congress, he said he needed to be in Congress to manage the Afghanistan war. That war went so well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you just ran a candidate that focused on, you know, those kind of top issues in Washington and kind of brought up, you know, congressman, you ran to manage this war that ended so poorly and cost us so much money. Why should you be in Congress? Why do you support these vaccine mandates by the president? You know, what are you doing for us regular citizens? I think some of these people might lose in shocking ways. But it first requires conservatives running candidates that match districts or match the statewide, you know, zeitgeist, whatever that may be.
Yeah, and the other thing that's looming is what these districts will actually look like when they're all redrawn, whichever map ends up getting the support. But that is for another day. Saul Spady, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. You're the best in the business. Always fun to join your show and talk politics with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I agree with everything that Saul just said. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show, the best show in the business. Now this.
The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rance, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
Oh, what a difference a year makes when that year has a whole bunch of crime and an election that didn't go the way the Democrats had hoped. We turn our attention to the city of Portland, our weird neighbors to the south. And we find that a year after they decided to push their version of defunding the police, where they ended up cutting even an anti-violence or a gun violence reduction team, it turns out they now want more money for the police. They want to invest now. They went from defund to refund. They're looking to put $5 million this fall into hiring more cops and buying body-worn cameras. Huh. Ted Wheeler, their mayor, did a press conference today, and he noted that many Portlanders no longer feel safe in their city. By the way, that's been the case for a very long time, and is due in large part because of your policies. But okay, yes, fine. Many Portlanders no longer feel safe in their city. Business owners have closed up shop for fear of doing business in high-risk areas. Well, that and the whole Antifa thing that you allowed to go unpunished and untouched. That part played a really big role, too. Like when the businesses were getting vandalized and you said nothing, and you have a Multnomah County DA and Mike Schmidt who was all like, yeah, it's all good. We agree with your protesting, so we're not really going to prosecute most of these crimes. I mean, that played a role, too. He says commuters fear for their safety, whether taking public transport or going by foot. Well, also, that's because of the homeless crisis that's completely out of control. Also, because of you and the council, of course. Now, in fairness to Ted Wheeler, he's not the only incompetent politician who is in charge in Portland. It's also their council. He says parents are scared to let their children play outside. Now, of course, you all know this is not something that just happened overnight. This happened due in large part to the policies that he put in place, that this council put in place, but also due to the new anti-policing laws, the police reimagining laws that went into effect on a statewide level, very similar to what's going on here in Washington State. In fact, I've got a story about that at foxnews.com about Portland's anti-police laws. It went up, last month or last week, so just text the key or type in into your Google machine, Jason Rance Fox News. It'll be the first one that pops up. This has been a year that you could have predicted almost to the number. Almost. They so far they're having a record year homicides. 72. The last high homicide rate was in 1987 with 66. That is insane. That is absolutely insane. The deadly violence in Portland, just like the deadly violence in Seattle, is unsustainable. Something has to be done or you end up losing your city for good. And so much like what's going on in Seattle with Mayor Jenny Durkin taking emergency action, using her executive authority, we'll see whether or not the council is going to try to stop it. But Ted Wheeler is also proposing a signing bonus to officers who get the job. It's $25,000. He's going to offer it to the first 50 officers or what he calls public safety specialists. You need cops, not public safety specialists. A cop is a public safety specialist, only they're armed and they can make arrests. He says he's supporting the hiring of 25 retired police officers back into the force as well. He said our police bureau staffing levels are at record lows, and based on projected retirement, staffing levels will continue to decrease unless we take decisive action now. I can tell you that they are going through, again, very similar stuff. Very similar things to what we are here in Seattle. And they're responding in exactly the same way from a mayoral standpoint. The difference, however, is that we don't yet quite know whether or not the council in Portland will approve this. My sense is we're going to find another similarity with Seattle in that the council will say no. That's what my guess is. Because here in Seattle, we can assure you that the remaining council members right now are anti-cop, with the exception of three. So they don't have yet a majority. It would be 6-3. Now, could you win over two of the anti-police council members in Seattle who are up for re-election next year? Maybe. I imagine it's going to depend on what the funding actually looks like and how they do it. But let's say you end up going ahead and getting that. Let's say you get the approval, thumbs up, blah, 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 blah. If that is true and it goes through, do you think cops are going to want to become cops in Portland or in Seattle or in the cities that councils still are overrun with the fringe leftists? You might win some support from the community going back into law enforcement or getting into law enforcement for the first time, maybe making lateral moves in Minneapolis, because in Minneapolis, they kicked out almost all of their council members who tried to defund the police, almost every single one of them. So they'll feel supported in Minneapolis because the voters said, we support you, officers. Now, the voters said that here, but not in big enough ways on the council side to make an officer think that if they were to get the job, they would make the lateral move, or if they forego their retirement that they were ready to take. Doesn't mean that they're still going to have support in this city. Not yet. Now, certainly, I hope that changes. I wish it changes. I hope it changes. But obviously, that's not something that we can guarantee. But you're starting to see the trend more and more and more and more. The police departments that saw their budgets defunded for the most part are now hearing calls to refund by the very same people who supported the defund. You're seeing the cities that had the highest rates of crime as a result of their attacks on police. You start to see that shifting now, too, with this election. That means there's some good news in store for all of us in the midterms if we keep this up.
The last rants.
Very quickly, I have a personal rant to get off my chest. As you know, I'm a very polite person. Everyone says how polite I am. Everyone is very appreciative of how I open doors for people, let people step in front of me instead of me going in first. When someone sneezes, I say, God bless you, mostly to ignore their calls that I not say God and annoy some of the atheists. But I will push that one aside. Everyone's all like, Jason is so polite. But there's some people who don't like me being polite. And they most likely don't like you being polite either. And it's some feminists. I had an encounter yesterday getting on the bus because I take the bus to humble me. That's how I can deflate my ego just a little bit, taking the bus, being amongst the people. By people, mostly homeless people and other people who just choose not to shower and then get on a bus for some reason and stink up the whole place. But I was there at the bus stop after a woman was, and she was kind of pacing a little bit because the bus was a little late as it normally is. So the bus arrives, the door opens, and I find myself standing in front, but I didn't get there first. And I also find it impolite to step onto things in front of women. I know we're not supposed to do that. And yes, it's different for a man versus a woman. I generally, unless it's an elderly person, I will walk on first if I was there first and if it's a man behind me. But if it's a woman, I'll let them walk in first because I was taught to be polite to women. And so I stepped aside and said, after you. And she gave me a look. She said, no, you go. And this is not the first time something like this has happened. Some people get really upset. They think it's sexist that you're being polite to them and you're treating them somewhat differently in a positive way than you would a man. Can you not get mad that someone is polite? It's not a slight. It's not a microaggression. If someone wants to, quote unquote, mistreat me or treat me differently than someone else and I benefit from it, then go ahead and do that. you're benefited by getting on a bus before me. I was trying to do the nice thing. I thought I was being polite, only to get snapped at, not for the first time, by yet another person who, my presumption is, based on the context that this keeps happening, doesn't like the fact that I let them on before me. I'm still going to let people on before me. I'll still take the angry snaps. But my God, consider what it is you're upset about. And if that's truly what you're upset about, because my assumption is that you're probably upset about a whole bunch of other stuff, the other stuff that you're complaining about, probably nothing. If this is what upsets you, we live in a great world where sexism doesn't actually exist. Now, of course, sexism exists, but if you think that this is the worst of the worst, well, your life is pretty privileged. Have a great weekend. That's The Last Rants.